I'm Colleen McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
We continue. Little lesson in constitutional history, but we'll go from that to Grant Newsham, who joins me from Taipei. Grant, good evening. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
A little press conference from New Jersey by a Baptist pastor that started talking about the First Amendment and religious freedom, and you can make no law to infringe on people's right to. And he's talking about American history, and you know some of these governors that are acting like dictators, and he starts talking about this, then this, and you're like, yeah, there's some people here who I think are getting confused about what the United States is all about. So it's very interesting. I hadn't intended to. When it was sent to me to watch the whole thing, but I found it a little bit of an interesting lesson in American constitutional history and what you can and cannot do in a nation that has an actual constitution. So anyway, not exactly in your neck of the woods in Virginia, but relatively close.
No, it is not relatively close. It's we always considered like anything. We considered like Baltimore. Somewhere on in another universe, lesser beings, of course. But when you went farther to Jersey, it just got progressively worse. So you're right, geography not far, but you know, us snobs, we look down on them.
So. The hybrids of Virginia, I forget.
Yeah, no, I actually heard somewhere on the internet a few weeks ago the governor of New Jersey.
Yep.
And I forget, Tucker Carlson or somebody asked him, like, well, you know, when you were imprisoning your entire population, did you pay any attention to the Constitution or the Bill of Rights? And he said, oh, no, that was above my pay grade. And, you know, and I had to think for a minute, and, yeah, that's New Jersey. But you know, well, what do you say? And that says a lot, I thought, but...
Well, you're waiting for this, and it's. I think it's beginning to come in places, but you know, that business can be open, but your business, even if it's the same kind of business, and even if you follow the same rules, yeah, you can't be open because I deem that you know you shouldn't be open. I mean, that's not normally the way they do it. We do it here in the United States.
No, it isn't. And
but you know, here's and I'll offer you this, and then we'll talk about Hong Kong. It's amazing to me, though. You and I were both alive. We were both kids in the '60s and watched all of that. I don't. It's like, are we more brain dead now that we're like, okay, well, if they say I can't do it, I can't do it. I mean, the attitude in the '60s was "fuck you, man." You know, we're. And that was unique to the 60s because the 50s were not like that. But the 60s, we're like, no, we're not doing that. And it doesn't seem like there's been a whole lot of pushback on any of these things. And you're looking at business owners losing businesses, all kinds of crazy stuff. So your thoughts on, are we more docile as a population? Are we stupider?
I don't know. There's no guarantee that we're smarter. I think we always assume we're going to be, every generation thinks the one before it were morons, which is never the case. But I think we could have actually gone backwards a bit. But you find that the people who were, you know, howling bloody murder in the 60s, you know, about freedom and nobody telling them what to do, sticking it to the man, et cetera, they're all the ones running the show now. And now they're doing exactly what they were complaining about. And if you actually read some of the accounts of the anti-war movement back then and the protests they would organize, and what you really noted was that really the petty desire for power in these organizations. And once that is what, you know, these the guys who run them, the pushy people who say, pick me, give me the microphone, et cetera, they all were, all they wanted to run the anti-war, the protests. And they would fight over who would get to hold the microphone. And that's ultimately what I think we're seeing, is that those people who claim to be principled, no, what they really wanted was power. And now that they and people like them are running the show, it's they're glad to use that power to stick it to the little man. And to me, it's not all that a surprise. And then you ask yourself, well, who of our elected representatives has actually stood up to all this and said, no, this is against the Constitution, it's against our rights, it is not how America acts? I'd be hard-pressed to name anybody in Congress except maybe Rand Paul, who's actually, as I say, has said, hey, wait a minute, this isn't what we should do. Instead, everyone has gone down complaining, or without complaining, in a way I never thought I would see Americans do. But, you know, what do I know?
Exactly. Exactly. No, it's kind of creepy, honestly. I mean, you can't in California for the longest time. It's supposed to be good to go outside. The virus doesn't survive, but parking lots at the beach closed, don't want to have too many people because you can't be trusted to do the right thing. So we are going to tell you what to do, and you can go to the beach, but you can't sit down on the sand at the beach. If you're running on the beach, if you're walking on the beach, if you're surfing, you know, and then they've closed the ocean for surfing for certain hours. So anyhow, it's honestly, it's a bit Orwellian. And mm-hmm. And also the other thing is, you could not have done this years ago because we were not as connected. So you didn't have the ability to reach the population the way you do now to control it. So if you're a fan of Orwell, I mean, this has to be an absolute delight to watch.
Oh, I don't think Eric Blair could have even dreamed of this. I had to throw that in because I'm from Virginia. It's for the benefit of the Baltimoreans. But
that was George
Orwell's real name was Eric Blair.
So snobbish.
Yes.
For no reason, I might add. That your heyday was what, 2 centuries ago? But what the hell? Let's talk about Hong Kong. Special status of Hong Kong. Could you explain that to everybody? The Brits used to own it back when Hong Kong was a good place. The Chinese took it over back in 1999 because the treaty ran out. What kind of hybrid status does Hong Kong enjoy?
A simple way to understand it is that it was for many years Hong Kong was a British colony, so it was pretty much part of Britain. Britain could not hang on to it forever because the Chinese wanted it back, and I could go into more detail, but Britain had to give it up, return it to China, and in I think 1984 or so, the British, when Mrs. Thatcher was still around, and the Chinese, communist Chinese, reached an agreement on the return of China. It was going to take place over 15 years-ish or so. So in 1997, the British and the Chinese had a big ceremony in Hong Kong at which Britain formally returned Hong Kong to China. So this was 1997. And the agreement said that for 50 years, Hong Kong would get considerable autonomy within China. So it would be essentially operate as a different sort of place. And the idea was to let it operate as it had always been, you know, a place with, you know, really a proper legal system, free trade, an honest bureaucracy, and a pretty honest police force at the time. And just very open to the outside, very easy place to go, to get out of, to go into. It would be this little zone of freedom and free trade within China. And the only thing that Hong Kong would not run would be its foreign affairs and the military. It wouldn't have a defense. That China would take care of that. And the idea was to let this go for 50 years. And then at that point, the deal had expired and China was free to do whatever it wants to Hong Kong. Nobody cared to think that they would do the worst. People just tend to ignore what the Chinese might do. 50 years seems like a long time. Say when you're like 50, or you're not going to be around for that. But 50 years did seem like a fair amount of time. And the idea was that China would sort of catch up to Hong Kong, both economically, but also in terms of being a sort of a more liberal, civilized place. And that things would somehow work out. You know, that was the idea, that in 50 years, it'll work itself out somewhere, or that the people who signed the treaty, none of them are going to be around. So, wasn't so much their problem. China has done is really from very shortly after the turnover in 1997, they started sort of narrowing down the freedoms that Hong Kong had, in particular ensuring that there was no fair elections. The idea was that Hong Kong would be able to choose its own Congress, its own leaders, its own governor. And instead, the Chinese cracked down on that and said that any governor had to be approved by them, if not, in fact, appointed. And they rigged the local legislature, the legislative council, so that it always had a majority of, I think, what you would fairly call pro-Beijing toadies, people who were pro-Beijing and would do what Beijing wanted. And by doing that, they really got their hands on the throat of democracy or consensual government in Hong Kong, and they've pretty much had that control since almost the beginning. And so Hong Kong has continued as a business center and a place that, where you do have more freedoms and you don't have that constant oppressive secret police sort of atmosphere compared to the rest of China. But it's been gradually narrowed down, and now it looks like it's coming to a head. And so whatever it is, 27 years early, China is going to impose its will on Hong Kong, it seems.
All right, so let's go from that to so that's kind of the state that Hong Kong has existed in. We've seen the protests of the last year, the citizens of Hong Kong on a pretty consistent basis turning out in mass, some huge protests in Hong Kong relative to, maintaining its own freedoms. What explain to everybody this latest piece of legislation that Beijing put forward.
Okay, but first I'll just point out that the protests that happened last year, these massive ones where like half the population or more actually came out onto the streets, those were actually driven by a proposed law that the local legislature was going to be pushed through that allowed people to be extradited with ease to the People's Republic of China, which meant that anyone in Hong Kong, potentially, if China wanted them, could legally bring them back to China and deal with them according to China's legal system, which is not what we would recognize as one. And no one in Hong Kong wanted that, or not many people did. And that's what those were actually about, was the possibility of a change in law which would allow people to be sent or brought back to the mainland without any recourse. And so now what you have is another law that people are unhappy about, and this one is being demanded or put forth by the National People's Congress, by the top dogs of the Chinese Communist Party in Beijing have said enough. We don't like these protests. They embarrass us. et cetera, et cetera. So they are putting forth a law. It's referred to as sort of a national security law. And what it does is it allows the government to punish anything that goes on in Hong Kong that they would call subversion, secession, terrorism, sedition, these sorts of things. And this would put on the books in Hong Kong a law which prohibits these acts. And it, on the face, it's kind of make, you know, many countries have laws like this, but everyone knows that what the Chinese Communist Party will do is it will use these to imprison, kill, etc., anyone in Hong Kong who protests or criticizes the Chinese Communist Party or who does something they don't like. And there's always been a degree of freedom from that, unless with some exceptions, that when the Chinese Communist Party kidnaps people and takes them across the border. But in general, that has not been possible. It's been considered against the law. But in Beijing, they're going to pass a law, it looks like, and they are going to force it onto Hong Kong one way or the other. They will either impose it directly, or they will have the local legislative council in Hong Kong, which once again is dominated by pro-Chinese people, and the head of it, Carrie Lam, is like a female Quisling is probably a pretty good way to put it. You're going to have to go to your dictionaries for Quisling. So they would go through the charade of having the local legislature pass it. And the people in Hong Kong, they realize exactly what this means, is that they will not be, they will always have this possibility of being, a bag put on their head and put into a black van and driven across the border if they say anything, either in public or private, that the Chinese Communist Party doesn't like. And the law also will give Chinese security services the right to openly operate in Hong Kong. And that's a big deal as well, because these are not a bunch of lover boys. These are rough people. And they've been operating in Hong Kong for a long, long time anyway. But this would just allow them to do it openly, really just to intimidate and to take care of people who displease them. And now, but the law, it's important to remember, it's useful to remember, that this a law very much like this was proposed in 2003, so 17 years ago. And there was protests in Hong Kong over that, the proposed law. And the government, both in Hong Kong and in Beijing, backed down. So that was 17 years ago. And now they're back at it. And it certainly looks like they are going to force this through.
Okay, and putting the bag, or getting the bag put over your head and being drugged into a vehicle and then taken to mainland China, or China proper, that's the pleasant part of that experience, just so everybody knows.
They'd probably sedate you as well, so it'd be even more pleasant.
Yeah, the tough part is going to come whenever you arrive at your destination, because those don't tend to be, we booked them, Mirandized them, and now we set them free. That's not generally the way that goes. Chinese authorities are taking pains, this out of the Wall Street Journal, to say the security legislation doesn't mean the end of Hong Kong's special status under one country, two systems, which has underpinned the city's role as an international financial hub and a crucial channel for Chinese companies and provinces to borrow money. Now, so I want to ask you about the why behind this. Why now? China's in the crosshairs of a lot of certainly Western democracies, a lot of nations around the world for its lack of action, and most of all, it's deliberate, I would say willful, misleading about the COVID-19 virus. In the midst of that, now this, why? And think hard before you talk, because like you're the big shot, Asia, Pacific Rim shit on this show? So this is like a big question, all right? So why?
I think that Xi Jinping, and when you say Xi Jinping, the top guy in China, you got to also say it's the guy and the guys around him and this huge chunk of the sort of the Chinese ruling class. I think that they think the time is right. There's a couple reasons here. That one is that these protests last year that were huge and got so much attention, so many people out on the streets that were entirely directed against the Chinese Communist Party, this gang that runs the People's Republic of China. And this was as embarrassing as anything could possibly be for them. Domestically, yes, but also internationally, it just made them look weak, made them look unpopular, like their citizens didn't like them. And that really sort of rankled, and you knew that they were going to pay Hong Kong back. But to do that, you had to be willing to take some heat from the rest of the world, particularly the West is what they would be worried about. And I think that the virus that emerged out of Wuhan, China, late last year, I think that that has caused so much trouble globally that I think that China sees it's got a window of opportunity, that everyone else is so busy worrying about how to deal with and how to recover from the virus that they're not really going to complain, although they'll complain, but they're not going to do anything. And that is part of the motivation there.
So the background noise is so great that we can slip this in under the radar. There'll be the typical angst, but other world events will eclipse this quickly, and this is the speed bump. So this is kind of like out of a communist playbook. Look for big news, and then execute your little green man or your gray zone strategy underneath the big event news and attention grabber?
Well, that's not a bad way to put it, is that they do look for cover, and we're always looking for what they can get away with. Now, there's make no mistake that China has always intended to get Hong Kong back into the fold one way or the other, and just a question of when. They couldn't wait 27 years, but when they could do whatever they wanted, but they were always looking to do this. But those protests last year, as I say, that was that really irritated, angered Xi Jinping and his cronies, and you knew that the payback was going to come, but you didn't know exactly when. But the virus has caused so much international disruption that I think they've have calculated that nobody is going to really do much more than complain. But also you look at the development of Chinese military power, that it's gotten to a point where nobody really wants to take them on, and so that has built up. Say compared to 10 years ago, they're a lot more militarily capable. That has a psychological effect on the Chinese leadership as well, that feels, well, if anyone wants to try something, go ahead. And they have almost rolled the dice, it seems, because what they've done, it doesn't leave them much room for maneuver. If you look at what they've been doing, even before this latest pressure on Hong Kong, if you go down the region, it looks like a Chinese fishing boat rammed a Japanese Navy destroyer off Shanghai a couple months ago. The Chinese Coast Guard was chasing a Japanese fishing boat in Japanese territory near the Senkaku Islands. The maritime and aerial intrusions by the Chinese military into Japanese territory are at record heights. They have gone stepped up the heat, the pressure on Taiwan with exercises designed to intimidate and designed to master the skills necessary for an invasion. They go down to Malaysia. They were harassing this Malaysian survey vessel recently, way down in the bottom end of the South China Sea. They've been pressuring the Indonesians, Philippines. They've got an all-out subversion campaign going. On the Indian border, there are three places. The Chinese have been sort of acting quite nasty since August, some people would say. And they've been pressuring and harassing and threatening all their neighbors, or many of them, for some months now. And it is, and then you also have their diplomacy, the so-called wolf warrior diplomacy, where they've turned their diplomats loose. And all they're doing is insulting people, threatening people. They refer to the Australians as really the gum on China's shoe, and threatening all sorts of economic harm if Australia doesn't do what China says, and if Australia demands an investigation into the virus's origins. So it looks as if they just don't care what anyone thinks of what they do, and are pretty much daring anyone to do something about it. And this is something we haven't seen for a sort of a good long while, if ever. And I think the thinking is that they are going to see what they can get away with and see who pushes back. And if nobody does, then you can expect a lot more of this, would be my guess. And Hong Kong gives you a pretty good foretaste of what may be in store for Taiwan.
I want to talk about that, but I want to talk about Australia first. Australia has been relatively outspoken. China, and then I think China put a cap on the beef they were going to import, and then they doubled down on that by saying, oh, yeah, and barley, and maybe they're going down to the list alphabetically, and they're in the B's now, because they said, oh, yeah, and that barley stuff? Yeah, you're abusing our trade relationship, so we don't need that anymore. Australia went to great lengths to say, oh, no, this has nothing to do with our request for the COVID-19 independent investigation. This is just a little bit of a trade situation, which always makes me think of this saying, are you going to believe me or your lion eyes? Okay. So Australia going through it right now, and it's the game that you've certainly made me savvy to, which is the economic extortion. You want access to sell into China? You'll play the emperor's new clothes with us, and you'll stay out of our business, and you'll dance the dance that we want you to dance. And it is not the dance of the rules-based order. It is the dance of whatever we say goes. Do you have... I hate to ask you pessimistic questions because I know you're going to give me a pessimistic answer, right? The term cautiously pessimistic that characterizes the Almarine Radio position on Afghanistan came from you, I think, relative to Afghanistan. So do you have any reason to believe that the free world that's hugely invested in a rules-based order will push back on China? And looming on the horizon is the place where you sit tonight. Taiwan.
It's one where you can see it breaking both ways. Before I answer that, I just wanted to mention another thing that's, I think, is driving Chinese behavior is that I think their economy is a real mess. They try to claim that they've recovered from the virus, their economy is picking up, but I think it is just a disaster. And I think that is also what is driving them. They do feel, I think to some extent, feel like they don't have much to lose, and it's a good distraction. So I just want to throw that out. In terms of actually sort of stopping this or, just getting China to sort of cool off and behave like a civilized country, that's going to be a challenge. But I think that the United States, since 2016, and who got elected in 2016, has actually started to do things that could have an effect. And that I think is grounds for optimism. It does depend, of course, and I think this next election is one that it is going to really be important when it comes to our international affairs. And the big thing in international affairs is China. this one country that is big and powerful enough and economically successful enough to really give us a run for our money for the first time in certainly in my lifetime and maybe in the existence of the United States, maybe since the War of 1812 when the British had us outmatched. But the I think that we have a chance if we, you know, keep doing more of what we're doing. And if you can, but you've also got to have sort of a more sort of unified approach in the United States where there is a widespread sort of agreement that China is a threat and that we need to do something about it. And maybe, and that maybe is one of the sort of hidden event, hidden blessings, if not a lot of silver linings of the virus, is that if you ask the average American citizen what they think of China, it's not very good. Right. And this is something that does get people's attention. Before, I don't think they'd have quite understood. But when you've, you know, killed 100,000 Americans, you've put 40 million of them out of work, and China is seen as the cause of that, that is something that just might unify the sort of the American populace. And maybe the our representatives will come along. There are Republicans who are pretty good, very good on this, and there's some Democrats as well. But in general, it is the Trump administration which really has allowed this sort of standing up for our interest to happen. And whether or not the Democrats will go along with that or a Democrat administration, I don't know. You know, that causes me some concern. But if the U.S. takes the lead and uses its really, its economic clout against and financial power against the Chinese Communist Party, and at the same time backed up by a military that nobody wants to take on and that has an alliance of like-minded nations in the region and globally, then I think you can present the Chinese Communist Party with a problem that they won't want to deal with. But it does require us to get our act together and do a number of things at the same time. So it's not a military. There's not a military solution to this. Though we'd better have a military that nobody wants to fight. And at the same time, you've got to get the economic, the financial, and the psychological and the propaganda wars right, or parts of the equation, and also get your alliances together and require your alliance partners to actually do something, not just sit back and admire us while we take the lead. So it's going to, we're going to have some leadership in Washington that keeps its wits about it. And I say with this administration, and I think we're closer to that than we've ever been. And on the other side of the aisle, and there are people who do understand the threat and are willing to do something about it. But this hatred of the current president is such that the Chinese must love it. And I think they would very much like to see President Trump gone. So that's a really long way of winded way of saying that there is some grounds for optimism. The game's not over at all. But and the Chinese may have jumped the gun, because now you always knew that there were a lot of people who could explain away why China was not a threat. And especially if they were on the Chinese payroll or were getting nice, all expense paid trips to visit the People's Republic of China and give speeches. There were all sorts of people who convinced themselves of that. There's less of that now. And there is also, as I said, the public writ large now, I think, knows more about China than they did before. So we see what the threat is. We see what China is like. And if this won't wake us up, it's hard to imagine what will. So I think we do have some reasonable prospects if we play it right. And that's how will we do? I don't know. But I'd like to say that the game's not over.
Wow, you sound optimistic, which is unsettling to me, to be honest with you. But I have an email here that I want to read to you. Mac, what are Grant's thoughts about the future of Hong Kong as the financial capital of the world if everybody sanctions Hong Kong for the sins of China? The future of Hong Kong, Grant, what do you think?
One thing about the, you know, as a financial center, if you think of the, if you know something about the people in the financial industry, I'm not being mean, but
you're about to though.
I'm being correct. I'm being accurate, but they, true. They will do whatever it takes to be able to, and they will cash their checks right up to the last minute. So I have a feeling, actually, that a lot of the Western financial community, I think that they will go to great lengths to contort themselves and to overlook what's going on in Hong Kong, overlook what the Chinese Communist Party is doing, and to try to keep whatever money-making deals they've got going, to keep that going, regardless of how the crackdown takes place. If you want to, you know, just have some cynicism about this industry, you look at the City of London. That's what they refer to London's financial center as.
Right, right.
And the they have welcomed East European, stolen East European money, welcomed East European criminals into the City of London for the last 20 years because they have money and have gone out to great lengths not to crack down. Just a telling anecdote. Remember when the Russians shot down that Malaysian airliner over Ukraine? And the first reaction from a guy from the City of London was, when they were talking about putting sanctions on Russia as a result, what he said was, well, what will happen to their money? And that tells you all you need to know. It will vary by degree. And there are, it's not like everybody is like that, but it's a very, that is not uncommon. So you look at Hong Kong, there will be a willingness to sort of to overlook whatever sort of rapacious, brutal behavior the Chinese Communist Party imposes. Is, you know, by more than you would think. But if the but at the same time, if the U.S. does crack down and actually imposes sanctions on Hong Kong, takes away the preferential treatments it has,
right,
and also puts sanctions on Chinese entities, say the People's Bank of China, for example, that you could find that. Even our financial industry, and it isn't just the financial industry. There's a lot of other U.S. businesses in Hong Kong that they just might be enough to get them to move elsewhere. You know, Singapore is often mentioned as an alternative, but you just might find that sort of a gradual outflow of companies either reducing their presence or moving out entirely, and that has a sort of a ripple effect on sort of the whole thing, on the whole economy in Hong Kong. And you could see that slowing down considerably. I don't think it's going to disappear. I think it would probably turn into something akin to Shanghai, where there's a lot of business and financial activity that takes place up there by people who want a piece of the action. And, you know, so I can't see it becoming a wasteland, but it may slow down. But there are going to be an effort, a great effort by the sort of the West, the foreign business and financial community to keep things going, to keep this gravy train going in Hong Kong as long as they can, longer than we might think it will. But it's gradually, if you go to, it's gradually, it is going to turn into just another Chinese city.
Right.
No matter what, I think what the Americans do or don't do, would be my take. And it's funny, you go there, go to Hong Kong now, and you would have no idea the British were ever there, except now and then you'll see a post box from the olden days and the street names and some of the buildings. But it's interesting how much the evidence of the British presence is gone. And I think that you will find if you go to Hong Kong, say 20 years from now, it just really might look like going to Shenzhen or some other Chinese city. And I think it is going to be a very different place, would be my guess. Can China survive the loss of Hong Kong? It was always a thought for many years that, well, that China would never do anything to Hong Kong because they needed the money that comes out of there. Maybe that was true at one point, but I think those days are long gone, that China's got enough financial wherewithal and enough foreigners and Westerners falling over themselves to get in there, that they don't really need Hong Kong in the way that they used to. And if it's a question of giving up some financial advantage in order to eliminate a very embarrassing challenge to Chinese Communist Party authority and power, I think they will go with the latter, that they'll do whatever it takes to appear to be strong and unassailable. And I think that's what will ultimately decide Chinese behavior there. I don't think the financial benefits they get from Hong Kong are big enough or essential enough to them now.
To offset the international embarrassment that's caused by the continued poke in the face of Chinese protesters flaunting their freedom, blah, 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 blah. So the juice isn't worth the squeeze. Talk to me about Taiwan Rising. Taiwan's performance in this whole COVID thing vis-a-vis the World Health Organization has got Taiwan a new light on the international public stage. I think Taiwan's perceived as having done things correctly, having been an honest broker. The performance, their public health performance is incredible. Many people believe that this step into Hong Kong bodes ill for Taiwan. How do you see Taiwan reacting to this? Do you see Taiwan Rising in the midst of the COVID thing and a window for maybe some of the barriers to Taiwan to come down based on China's display of arrogance and recklessness in terms of the monetary cost for other nations around the world, the cost in human life for other nations around the world? Do you see Taiwan ascending?
I think this has certainly helped Taiwan's position and its reputation, but I don't know what the actual effects will be in terms of getting Taiwan more recognition and sort of decent treatment by other civilized nations. It may be sort of haphazard and partial, where you say, for example, the Czech Republic have been kind of pretty brave in standing up for Taiwan lately and staring down Taiwan. The Swedes have closed, for example, all their Confucius institutes, these Chinese alleged education establishments in Sweden, closed them all down. And they've got a very bad relation with the PRC right now. And the Swedes, who knows, might be one to give Taiwan a break, give them some recognition. This administration, the Trump administration, has been very strong, pretty strong on Taiwan, more than any other put together. And there is even a lot of democratic support for that. But so it's kind of helped. But in terms of the tangible results, I don't know that it's going to actually lead to that. There's still this sort of perceived economic attractiveness of China, and also a fear of China that I think restrains a lot of people. But it is certainly, things have developed in Taiwan's favor, but a lot more has to happen. Some more Chinese overreaching would actually break. Sort of break the civilized world loose or free in terms of really welcoming Taiwan into the group, the club, as a sort of a respected civilized nation. But you noticed recently the Americans couldn't, and their friends couldn't, get Taiwan much better treatment by the World Health Organization. So China still has a lot of influence with a lot of sort of lesser countries, but the numbers do add up. But China's, I think, Taiwan's the value of it and the importance of it, and really the things that one should admire about the place as a really as an evidence that Chinese can handle the consensual government and all the human freedoms that the Chinese Communist Party says Chinese people can't handle. And Taiwan has elections, and when you lose an election, you leave office. So it's, you know, Taiwan is looking pretty good at not just its virus response, but now that China has sort of thrown down the gauntlet and bared its fangs and said, we don't care what anyone thinks about us, Taiwan looks a lot even better. But how that will play out, I'm not entirely sure. But the Chinese Communist Party's perspective, Taiwan is an existential threat by its very existence, because it does give a lie to this entire lie that the only way to handle Chinese people is with a boot on the neck, and Taiwan is the exact opposite. So I think one should not underestimate just how serious the Xi Jinping and his crowd are when they issue threats against Taiwan. I think they are, in fact, serious about that, and we had better take them at their word.
It's interesting. And again, much of it revolves around the collective response of the free nations in a rules-based order, which we have yet to see happen. An email question. Does Grant believe President Trump actually has a plan relative to China, or is he just rolling the dice every day?
Oh, I think he's got a plan. You know, that's it, and I think he's had it from the beginning, or very close to the beginning, because he's had, as I've mentioned before, he's got some excellent advisors on his staff who really know Asia and know China, and also know something about planning and putting together a sort of a comprehensive, systematic approach to dealing with a challenge like Hong Kong, like China. But the question is a good one, because you do always wonder about any administration if they've really got a plan. But this is actually one where I would say that they do. It's the first time that it's had a combination of people who really understand the region, who understand the true nature of the Chinese Communist Party, understand what the Chinese want and what they plan to do, and are willing to do something about it, and are not being distracted by other things. So they actually do have a plan. They actually put out something a couple of weeks ago, or a week or two ago. It was like 16 pages, which is kind of long. But it was designed to sort of lay out the administration's approach to China in terms of what they're doing and why. So this is, I think, actually a question that, you know, I think there's a good answer to, and I think they do have a plan. You'll note that I'd call it that sort of the snarky opposition, particularly by the China hands. And I think a guy like Henry Paulson, the former head of Goldman Sachs, who's, you know, been to China many, many times, and he's never seen it from outside a limousine or a 5-star hotel. And doesn't speak a word of Chinese, but he, you know, he'll tell you that, you know, China's great guys, and he's made a fortune off of it. But he comes immediately to mind because I heard him say it recently. They use this expression about the Trump administration towards China, and they say, oh, they have an attitude. They don't have a plan. And that is, it's either a lie or they're really stupid, and these are not stupid people. But that's the excuse or the snide comment about this administration. Oh, it just has an attitude towards China. No, if standing up for America's interests and doing it in a more systematic, effective way than every administration, really since Kennedy or Eisenhower, if that's having an attitude, well, that's fine. But no, that's simply because they will not look at what the administration has actually done. Are there things I would have done a little differently? Yeah, probably. I would have been, I think, harder on the Chinese earlier on. But that's a judgment call. But this administration has been very good in towards China. So if you follow it long enough and you just see how abysmal our approach towards China has been, that this one, it just really jumps out at you. And the big concern you have is that it will just be a flash in the pan or a temporary thing, and we will go back to this idea of engaging with China because we have to. We have no choice. And the cliche that you hear from officials and military, senior military people is, oh, we will engage where we can and confront where we must, which is pretty much saying we'll give them exactly what they want and we'll do everything not to make us, not to make the Chinese unhappy. But you hear that all the time, and it's supposed to sound really intelligent. But the Chinese hear it and they say, oh, great, we're dealing with idiots here. You know, I'm not being snide, but that, you know, you've got 40 years of empirical evidence. You can kind of sort of figure things out. So, but this administration's been a good one. You know, so I hope it continues, and that's what's at stake, to my way of thinking, with this next election.
Do you believe that the Chinese will follow through on the trade agreement, say, they made, or the United States takes action against China for what they did in Hong Kong? The Chinese, who probably never, may or may not, maybe that's their way of interfering in this, and I don't know that they're that well thought, but intervening in our election is creating more turbulence. Now, because you've enacted these policies, we will now, you know, not follow through on what we've agreed to do. But you made the point that that hurts them more than it hurts us. So will the Chinese follow through, do you think, on the trade agreements they've made?
Well, only if they have to, would be my, they'll go to great lengths to not do what they say they will. They'll only do what is in their interests or which they can't avoid. I don't know, I'm not all that optimistic about the trade agreements, not least because the final results of the final versions of these were very different than the ones which were agreed to. And then at the last minute, the Chinese, at Xi Jinping's orders apparently, and his crowd, they basically tore the whole thing up. And so what you've got now is not a very impressive agreement from my perspective. So I don't put much hope in them keeping their promises on this. I think it really, they will only do it if they have no choice. And or change behavior if they have no choice. So I'm not all that impressed with the trade agreements. You know, so how, for example, you know, how are you going to get China to stop stealing intellectual property or shaking down foreign government, foreign companies in China? How are they going to get them to do that unless they feel like if they don't, they're going to get punished? And if the idea is they are going to make the promise just because they made the promise, because it's a nice thing to do, that they don't operate that way. It has to be a cost-benefit sort of thing with them. And they see that, well, if we don't do this, we're going to lose this and get in this much trouble. And that's the – so with the trade agreements, I would say I'm not all that impressed. And you know, one way to thing to consider when you're thinking about, you know, how can you apply effective sort of economic and financial pressure on China is that, you know, as we've talked about before, one of their great vulnerability is that their money is, nobody wants it. It's like Confederate money, kind of. And so if they don't have foreign exchange, it really
puts where was the capital of the Confederacy?
Excuse me?
Where was the capital of the Confederacy?
Oh, it was everyone knows, you don't, Virginia, they would have put it in Baltimore, but that was the other side of Washington, I'm told. But the, no, it's, but anyway, so I know something about Confederate money. But they, but that's a real weakness. And if you go after them on that, sort of that front, that's potentially very effective. As we say, we've talked about this before. But another thing to consider is that the, you know, you used to hear this with senior U.S. military types, that something called cost imposition when it came to China. And the idea was, well, we'll put so much cost on them that they will change their behavior for the better. And you've seen other administrations actually use this notion as well, as if you could just put the pressure on them just enough and they will then become like nice like Canadians. But I would suggest that, well, there's no amount of sort of cost that the Chinese cannot bear. It's like the Germans putting pressure on the Russians. You know, they sure seemed like the Russians could absorb any amount of pressure that you could put on them, and the Chinese too. But the better way to look at it is to consider imposing costs on the top Chinese Communist Party leadership. Because, say, there's 80 or 90 million Chinese Communist Party members, there's only, a few thousand that are really important and that really matter. And these are the ones who have the overseas real estate, who have the bank accounts, a lot of it in the U.S., who have relatives with green cards. And I can't think of another historic example where a major power that's sort of up and coming like this, where the most successful people have gone out of their way to put their wealth and their family members in the country that is their biggest enemy. And that is something that we should take some optimism from. But it also puts them at a disadvantage, these people. You can see how their wealth, their loot, is at risk. You know, if the administration was wise enough to target it and go after it, that would be sort of something to consider. And plus, if you even just publicize the daylights out of this, so everybody in China knows that, say, of the top 500 people in the Communist Party, you know, 480 of them have real estate in New York City, have bank accounts with this much in it, et cetera, that would be something that would be a cost that you could impose on a part of China that I think would potentially be effective and is worth considering, and I'm sure people have. But that's, something to consider is when you're trying to punish China or pressure China to just act like everyone else does, that you do want to target whatever it is you're doing. Otherwise, you're not likely to have a huge effect, and I would give special mention to the People's Bank of China, sort of the national bank. Effectively, if you cut that off from the U.S. dollar system, you know, that alone would that'd be worth about 12 more aircraft carriers if we were to build them. So, just a few ideas.
All right, I'll let you go with this final email. Mac, what is the one thing Grant believes that Western nations could do that would be most effective vis-a-vis China and getting it to operate underneath the rules-based order? Kind of an interesting question, Grant. What's the one thing that you believe would be most effective?
Require strict reciprocity in all dealings with China, all sort of business and financial dealings in particular. And that would be an excellent baseline from which to start. So if we can't invest freely and not get cheated and harassed in China, then no Chinese investment in the West. Similarly, you have to, go after that financial lifeline, because we have funded the rise and growth of the Chinese Communist Party. Is you have got to stop pouring billions and billions of dollars into China, and you know, one way to do that is you simply make it illegal for any publicly, registered or licensed or publicly traded company to invest in a country like China. And one way to be useful to give China the treatment that old South Africa got, where you make it not just unlawful to invest in the country, but also make it distasteful. You know, you'd like to see movements on college campuses to protest any companies that invest in a place with concentration camps, that takes organs out of live prisoners, that, you know, you'd like to see something like that. But go after the economic financial lifeline or the pipes that go in, pour resources, technology, and money into China, but also don't let them invest in our places. You know, why should we allow a country like this to invest in our markets? Those would be the things that I think would be the most effective. But, you know, if nothing else, just pure reciprocity in our relationships with China would be a very good thing to do. The idea always was that, well, you know, they'll eventually catch up. They'll eventually figure out the rules of the game, and they don't, you know, they don't want to act the way they are. They just don't know any better. I mean, that was the thinking, but, you know, they knew exactly what they were doing. And if you're dealing with gullible people, well, you got to hand it to them. So that's what would be what I would recommend. You know, it's that experience of the Confederate States of America not having enough Yankee greenbacks that I guess that somehow it stuck with me. But China's got that problem, and that's where I would go after them. The military end, you had better stay on top of that and make sure that nobody wants to fight us. But I think the real vulnerability is financial and economic.
All right. What's the next thing you're going to write?
I forget. There was something that, goodness. I've just written something about sort of like what's going to look like in Asia after the virus blows over. Which is sort of, it covers a number of the things I've mentioned tonight. But so I think I've written enough for a day or two, but I'm not sure what the next one was. It's something about the Commandant's plan. I was asked for something lengthier on it, so I'm still figuring out what I think about it. But
we'll wait very anxiously for that.
Yeah. Well, I'm pretty much a yes man, so you can guess where I'm going to come out. No, I couldn't. No,
I don't think.
I hope not.
That's not really my sense of you, so.
Yeah, if I was that is the surest way to the top I have discovered, is to be a world-class yes man. My advice.
The older that I get, the more sagely that advice becomes, because I think at the end of the day, the people that run the world are high-performing conformists.
It took me much longer to figure this out than I wish it had. I didn't figure it out soon enough to do me any good. But if there's one thing I'm sure of, that is the surest way to the top, is to be a world-class yes man or an accomplished brown noser.
There you go.
And the exceptions are just that. That's advice that I give to MBA classes when I speak to them.
But as we all know, exceptions do not disprove the rule. They are exceptions to the rule. So anyway, well, first of all, as always, Grant, appreciate you staying up so late. And it's just the timing of the. You would think that, you know, as a Chinese communist, you know, you would think that, well, we're getting so much bad media, and we're constantly in the news these days with our COVID-19 response, and we're trying to transform that into this great selfless Chinese response. So we're stuck in, you know, we're very much in the midst of that, and now added to that is events in Hong Kong. So, but I think it certainly does make sense in using a catastrophic event that the world is consumed with as top cover for moving their cheese a little bit more. The boa constrictor tightens its wrap a little bit more, and so from that perspective, I think it certainly does make sense.
I agree. It's if one is if you think a certain way, and regimes and people like the Chinese do, that it is they see a good opportunity here to see what they can get away with, and so we'll see how this plays out. But it's going to get pretty interesting, I think, in the coming months.
All right, sir. Well, first of all, thank you as always for staying up so late, and we certainly appreciate the visit, and have a great end of May and a start of June, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks very much. Always enjoy it.
There you have it. Grant Newsham here on a what is it? Tuesday morning. Feels like Monday. But appreciate, as always, Grant joining us and making us smart. If you're just tuning in hour one, we do a little bit of First Amendment radio in addition to Memorial Day radio. Yeah, Memorial Day. I think rather than getting angry at people for, you know, different things, from not putting flags out to Happy Memorial Day and stuff like that that we've discussed, just look at it as an opportunity to educate. And that's what it is. And I offer you the words of Jesus Christ, Jesus of Nazareth. Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. They're just not educated. I don't think that most people on Memorial Day would do anything to offend anybody, but having never served, they just don't know. And then we talk about a little bit, some interesting stuff. Churches are pushing back, and they're being told they're non-essential and can't open. And a lot of them around the country have said, oh no, we're opening, and we'll see you in court. And so I played, you know, some of a press conference from New Jersey that got sent to me that talks about the fundamental right as Americans to assemble and worship. And that the Constitution does not get suspended during a time of crisis. So I think it's pretty interesting, you know. I think it's pretty interesting. So you'll hear that. And the first part of it is okay. And then at about 6 minutes into it, the pastor, his last name is Reese, you know, he starts laying out the cases. Hey, this is what our role is. This is how our right to assemble and worship is guaranteed in the Constitution. It is the first right that's enumerated in Article 1, I think. So anyway, you'll hear that. And then you'll hear, if you caught the tail end of Grant, you'll hear him. And we talk about Hong Kong. We talk about why the timing of this now. We talk about Hong Kong's special status relative to the treaty and how it was supposed to transition to full Chinese rule in 50 years. But the Chinese seek to accelerate that timeline. So all of that. Tomorrow, Scott Husing, company commander, Echo Company, 2nd Battalion, 4th Marines in Iraq, in Ramadi, Iraq, wrote a book called Echo in Ramadi. He had a piece published over the weekend about Memorial Day. So I want to talk about that with him. So Scott will join us tomorrow morning at 09:05, and we'll talk to him. Until then, have a great day. Hang in there. Don't be afraid to change somebody's life for the better. It'll change yours. So, on a Tuesday, Almarine Radio, over and out.